Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. What a show we have. So I want to ask you how you're doing. Okay. Now, how do you think you'll be doing in 5 years from now? How about 10 years from now? How about 15 years from now? How do we project into the future on what's going to happen and how we're going to deal with life? What's this future going to be like that we can handle? Well, it doesn't look promising. And there's a lot to be worried about. Yet, there's change. And we're going to talk to the author of a book called Resilience. That's how we're going to survive, is through resilience. Resilience and the Future of Everyday Life is this great book that is actually changing my outlook. It's amazing how powerful it is in that. And the author is James H. Lee, L-E-E, and he's a guest on the show. Jim, welcome.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm great, and I'm so glad you could join me to talk about this wonderful book that you've written and what it has to offer us in ideas, in understanding how life has changed and is continuing to change in ways that for many people is unsettling, but you've really looked at a better side of it. So I congratulate you for that.
Thank you. I appreciate that. You know, it kind of reminds me of an old song by the band REM. You know, it's the end of the world as we know it, but we'll feel fine. And at the end of the day, I think that we'll see some social transformations that will bring us to a new place, and we'll come out of this better than we went in, that's for sure.
Well, a lot of people have written about how we're going to shift our consciousness towards more cooperative society and how we can expect to lose so many of the hierarchical natures of today's society. And so you take that and run with that. It's, you know, that's what you've done in your book. You've shown so many ways that our society is changing and will change to make it more user-friendly.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And, you know, you talk about the flattening of hierarchies, and one of the trends that futurists talk about is the loss of the middle, whether it's the middle man, whether it's the middle market, whether it's middle management. And what seems to be happening is that knowledge and information in particular is becoming more accessible to everyone. And I think that that's a very positive thing.
Right. The internet has helped us connect and inform. And so you have many chapters in the book that talk about how this information, how usable it is, and how we can work with it better.
Yeah, and you know, beyond just being able to access information a little bit more freely in social networks, we're also beginning to see how the internet's really changing our relationships to our stuff. And that one of the trends that I follow in the book is the movement away from ownership towards this concept of access, okay? And it's my belief that through any number of sites, you know, such as Craigslist and so forth, that people are going to get better at sharing things. And the result is that we'll be able to do more and more with less and less until we can do absolutely anything with just about nothing. And I think that's really interesting.
Well, I want to add a few more words to what you just said. It's really we've been living in the concept of how much can you own, mm-hmm. versus not just ownership, but how much can you own.
Right.
Moving into a future of how much can you access.
Right. That's it. And, you know, what you talk to is what I refer to as the bigger, faster, more syndrome, which is sort of this very modern interpretation of what we need. And what we need is bigger, faster, more in everything. And that type of value system is what I believe has sort of led us into a situation where we have both an economic crisis and an environmental crisis as well, and they share a common cause.
Well, I think the economics is more powerful for the population than the environment.
Short-term, yes. Yeah.
Short-term, right. So people don't think so much of, I mean, a lot of people do, but a lot of people don't think of how something's going to help the environment so much as they think about what they can't afford and how they have to start minimizing.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember the gas crisis, when gasoline got so expensive, it became obvious that we had overdone it in terms of bigger and more powerful automobiles and trucks.
Mm-hmm.
And how can we start actually being more efficient? And then because of the housing bust, a lot of people have had to downsize and sell off their McMansions. And actually, you talk in the book about maybe those McMansions will be more useful for shared use and access than ownership.
Yeah, I definitely see that as a trend, and that really family and friends is becoming the new Social Security, as it were. And one of the better ways or more effective ways of dealing with an economic crunch is having more people under one roof. And that's taking any number of forms, whether you're having an increase in multi-generational households to people that are just renting out spare bedrooms in their house. And, you know, it's one way of sharing your expenses or creating another stream of income.
Yes, and I've had my family, still living at home because of the access opportunity, and even some friends have taken advantage of that with us. So it's nice to have a sense of sharing space with people, and it does have its complications, and it's not always simple or easy, but we have to learn how to get along better in order to share better.
That's right. I think in the end, what happens is through the traditional concept of ownership, we've also had an increased level of separation in our culture and also loneliness. And by realizing that we're all in this together, we're going to come out of it with a stronger sense of place, community, and family. And those are all very powerful things.
A lot of people think we're becoming more impersonal due to the internet. What's your feeling about that?
That's an interesting thought. For me, the internet seems to be broader, but in some ways a little shallower. Okay, the relationships that you might keep with the people on your Facebook page are not going to be as deep or as profound as the relationships that you have with your family. But it also enables you to keep in touch with people, far, far away in different time zones, too. So
I love it. I've been sharing photos from the past on Facebook and connecting with people from the past. And it's so enjoyable. We all have different feelings about the past and connecting with it. But moving forward, certainly we can. A lot of people who do feel alone can make new friends and connect. And there are a lot of I don't know what the percentage is now. Maybe it's in your book on how many current relationships and marriages there are of people who met on the internet.
Wow. I don't know how many people have actually met on the internet, but it's kind of becoming the default tool for people that are looking to enter into relationships. I know any number of people that have met on Match.com or other dating services, and it seems to work.
Yeah. And so, you know, there's so many ways that the internet works, and certainly about education, informing us. And you have chapters on how people can learn to homestead, mm-hmm. and how to get into more crafts and live more hand to mouth, live in nature, use nature, plant gardens, share gardens. I like the sharing part, and so there's a lot of bartering. Let's talk about bartering. I think that's an important part of your book.
Sure. Yeah, you know, bartering has been around since almost the beginning of time. And what we've seen, particularly in Greece and some of the other countries dealing with, you know, a somewhat more intense form of crisis, is that people are going back to the things that worked. Okay. And exchange of goods and services is one of the basics. Some of the things that I find really interesting in bartering, probably the newest twist on bartering that I can think of, is this whole idea of time banking. And the concept is that people who have a lot of money don't necessarily have a lot of time, and people with a lot of time don't necessarily have a lot of money. So what it is it's really an internet-based bank that enables you to volunteer hours for your community to do things that you're good at doing. And it could be cooking, it could be teaching a Spanish, it could be doing yard work, it could be accounting, it could be legal work.
And so you don't have to run out and find some particular person to barter with. You actually barter into a bank.
You barter into the bank, and your time is basically a deposit that you make into the bank. And then what you can do is you can look up basically anyone in your community who's participating who offers the type of service that you're looking for. And what it does is it avoids an economic issue called a coincidence of needs. So you're not necessarily looking for someone who needs to have their taxes prepared, if that's what you do. You're pooling your resources and you're pooling your time within your community. And what they're finding out is that it's creating the sense of interconnectedness. People are meeting other people within their communities. It's also great for entrepreneurs who are looking to build up their customer lists and their experience and their reputation as they start up new service businesses.
Yeah. You know, there's often I get people asking to trade with me, and yet what they have to trade isn't necessarily anything I want.
Right.
So
right.
This way, we just work through the bank.
Yeah, it's really a nice thing, and again, you get to develop some skills that you might not have had otherwise. What we're also seeing is that there are some more formalized types of barter markets, specifically for businesses, such as Trade Market Now or BarterConnections.com. And those are helpful for businesses in particular with managing their cash flow. You know, businesses need to preserve their cash, and to the extent that they have services or goods that they can trade, it actually helps them maintain their lines of credit better. So, you know, it makes sense even for more established businesses too.
Also, there's local currencies that I'm not familiar with. I'm in New York. We don't have a local currency.
Oh,
and
wow.
I'm excited. I don't know how many of our audience is familiar with different cities that have their own currency.
Yeah, that's, you know, a lot of people are really surprised to hear about that. And it's kind of a type of radical local economics, which is really getting hold here in the U.S. And now, surprisingly enough, there are now about 100 local currencies within the country right now. And one of the newer ones is called the Baltimore B Note. And how that works is you go to a bank, and for the equivalent of 90 U.S. cents, you get $1 worth of Baltimore B Notes, which are then used at any number of local businesses within the city of Baltimore, just like you would use conventional cash. And, you know, how it works is basically it's like a 10% off discount for buying local.
And once, it encourages you because it's hard to get your money back.
well, yeah, how that works is there's sort of two things involved here. One is that it doesn't earn interest, and money that doesn't earn interest, you have a little bit more of an incentive to spend it a little sooner. So it tends to circulate a little faster. And because it doesn't really have any value outside of Baltimore, what it does is it builds and enhances your local economy. And you can actually reimburse them, I believe, you know, for 90 cents on the dollar if you wish. But given that it's worth a dollar of local goods, it generally makes sense just to keep it.
That's great. And but in New York, we might not have a local currency, but we do have food swaps.
Oh, yeah.
And you talk about, well, you talk about that in the book. And it's fascinating to me that when you get a group together that swap foods, what people come up with.
Well, yeah. I mean, one of the things that I did here in my neighborhood is I started up a local farmer's market, and you just realize how much you're missing at the grocery store, just in terms of different varieties of green beans or beets or whatever. And you can do better. You can get better variety. You can get, you know, food without pesticides or fertilizers if you do it yourself. The problem that everyone has is that there's usually one thing that they're really, really good at, okay? In my case right now, it's cucumbers.
And good. Those are very
too
healthy.
Many of them. And, uh-huh. And what do you do, right? Uh-huh. And some of the swap markets enable people to focus in on what they're good at and experiment and try some things that, again, they just can't get at the grocery store. So that's really an extension of what I refer to as the homesteading movement. And that's a whole nother chapter in the book.
Right. You have many chapters here that each have a different way of analyzing, for instance, the workplace. It's interesting that we are working differently nowadays. There's each generation, and you name each generation. I'm from the silent generation. I don't know that we're so silent, but people born during World War II or before, and we are one of the smaller groups now, and we have in general have a different outlook on life, and maybe a little harder to change because we really live so long in the old way. But then we have another group that's the baby boomers, and most people are who I know now are baby boomers, and there is a very large segment of the population, people born between 1945 and 1960. My wife is a baby boomer, and they have a bit of a different approach to life than us older folk. And then there's Generation X, born between 1960 and 1980. And then there's the millennials, Generation Y, and those are people born from 1981 to 2001. And my two sons fall in that category. And it was fascinating that you've identified the different approaches to life that each group has and what they expect of life. And how they, and what they, you know, what they want, and it's pretty exciting that the younger generations now are really born into this age, and they're faster, quicker at making moves. They you can describe it better than I can.
Yeah, and that was really one of the pleasant surprises that I got out of this book, is really just how many parents are sharing it with their adult children to create sort of a dialogue, and it's helping people understand other generations and why they do the things they do. And one of the principles behind the book is that we're all experiencing change right now, but the way that we deal with it is going to be a little bit different based upon how long we've been around. Okay, so yeah. So generally speaking, what I'm finding is that people, born really before or during World War II, you know, by and large, aren't having to make a lot of changes right now. I mean, you have the pension plans in place, you have Social Security, you have sort of a traditional way of doing things that, you know, you can probably just kind of keep going, you know, on autopilot, and the world's not going to change too much over that time span. But then when you look at the younger folks, you know, the millennials and the current generation being born right now, which is called the homeland generation, they have an entirely different set of expectations, an entirely different economic paradigm, and just worlds apart.
And it's amazing what they're faced with are opportunities that us older folk don't even understand.
Oh, you don't? No. And you know, the whole paradigm of work has changed dramatically between the generations. I mean, for my father, who was born in 1939, he started his first full job, his first real job at around the age of 26 with DuPont, and he stayed with them for about 40 years. Within what I refer to as the career ladder. You know, you start at the bottom and you work your way up to the top, and it's a very linear type of progression. The baby boomers sort of changed the career ladder into what I refer to as the career lattice, which meant that you're still climbing upwards, but you might make a horizontal move to another business or another company, doing similar types of work, and then you try to climb up as high as you can. And that paradigm has gone as well. So the people who are in their 20s and 30s right now, their way of looking at the world isn't the ladder, it's not the lattice, it's what I refer to as the patchwork crazy quilt of opportunities, by which you're seeing people having three, sometimes four jobs. They may be in entirely different fields. They're part-time, and what they're trying to do is they're trying to stitch together different work opportunities in a way that's flexible and covers their needs. And that's the paradigm that we seem to be going into.
It's amazing how that can work, and it can work because of communications. We're so connected now that we can do many things at the same time through the internet, most of all, and using our smartphones. And it's fascinating how many opportunities there are to be in more than one place at one time.
Yeah, and it's leading to the three disappearances, okay? You have the disappearance of jobs, and a lot of that's been going out to outsourcing, and that's been happening for years now. But more recently, you have the disappearance of the work week in terms of the 9-to-5 work week seems to be going away, plus the disappearance of the workplace, and that you have many people who are telecommuting or working out of a spare office bedroom or whatever. So it's all changing, but more specifically in the digital economy and less so in the physical economy.
Right. And so, well, the physical economy has to do with caretaking, with where we need hands on, feet on the ground.
Right.
And,
right.
And that will always be important.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's talk about households and how that has changed. And what, you know, we talked earlier about, you know, sharing space. But we also have different assortments of people who are families now.
Yeah. Oh, it's true. And our concept of family is changing radically. And what we think about as the family has actually changed no fewer than three times over the last 100 years. You know, we started out in 1900 with about 50% of the population engaged in farming and agriculture. And what made sense during that time was the extended family, where you had grandparents, children, and grandchildren all living together under the same roof. Then right around World War II, we moved into the nuclear family, which is two parents and two kids living together. And as they get older, they become empty nesters, as it were. And right now, we're kind of moving into the stage that I refer to as the post-nuclear family, which is the traditional family mutated into any number of new forms. So You have a big rise in the extended family, which is now about 18% of the U.S. Has households of three generations or a younger generation plus a grandparent generation. You have families that may have two moms and two dads, and we're definitely seeing a big uptick of that in the U.S. And you're also seeing about 11% of the population in families of one at this point. And that's not necessarily an optimal situation. So what it's doing is it's opening up to what I refer to as found families, which is people that may not necessarily be related by blood or marriage, but they're related by preference and convenience.
When I was growing up, everybody thought when you get to about 65, you just pull up a rocking chair and cruise. And now you have a chapter in the book about eldering, and it's really about us older folk not seeing that there's a ceiling anymore. There's no time. Actually, we're too busy. It's amazing how exciting life stays. And I guess a lot of people now, even there might be a consciousness about getting too bored, and we've got to keep moving, got to keep creating new things and new ideas and new opportunities.
Yeah, you know, I've worked as a financial planner for a number of years, and I've seen a lot of people engage in the retirement process. And once they leave work, they're kind of surprised that they had time to do anything at all beforehand, you know, when they had a job. And, you know, the paradigm of retirement seems to be shifting away a little bit from quitting and, you know, playing golf and tennis to just doing something else and finding your passion and focusing on that with economics as a little bit more of a secondary consideration. But in order for that to really work, you have to have your financial house in order, and you have to have your debts paid off. And that's still proving to be a challenge for some.
Right. And there are a lot of challenges ahead. And what I like about the book is that it's so full of ideas of opportunity that I'm very inspired having read it. I really feel that it's added a lot of value to my life now that I can think in terms of making things work in new and different ways. And I think everybody should reach for this book, Resilience and the Future of Everyday Life. Where can they find it?
Yeah, it's available online at both Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. We have print copies available, paper copies, and also copies for the Kindle and the Nook as well, so you can download it.
Right.
And there are some parts of the book that I also keep on my blog as well, which I update fairly regularly, which is resilience-economics.com.
Oh, that's great. And I it's an opportunity that people should take advantage of just to create a new excitement and challenge in life, to make more of it, and overcome so many of these limitations that we're facing, and make life much more interesting and fulfilling. So James H. Lee, L-E-E. Jim, thank you so much for being a guest on Energy Stew. It's so great to talk about this in an basically an optimistic way. I know the first part of your book, you know, isn't so rosy, because you talk about why we need to do all this and how many potential hazards there are in the world. And yet we all know that. We don't know it in as much detail as you might point to in the book, but we know that we have to change. And you're book is so filled with information, all kinds of websites to go to. I love that. There's so many websites I'm going to check out from your book. So I want to thank you so much for doing such a great job on this.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed it. And I hope to make a change for people. There is just so much gloom and doom out there that people are just looking for better alternatives.
Great. Jim Lee, thank you so much. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com or PRN.FM. And I can be reached at peter@heartriver, H-E-A-R-T, river.org, or 212-222-7748. Lots of classes coming up, all kinds of great stuff. So stay tuned, tune in, and or contact me. And thank you so much for listening.